Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and now we're hearing it could happen tomorrow morning. That's the latest report about when Barack Obama might announce his choice for vice president to supporters who've signed up on his website. Meanwhile, John McCain will reportedly name his candidate right after next week's Democratic convention to try to take the wind out of his opponent's sails. Well, there's a good chance you've been under sail or hiking or watching other people do strenuous things at the Beijing Olympics. So today we start with a check-in on the presidential campaign. By the way, we'll check in Beijing in a few minutes in the program. But to start, here to catch us up on the presidential trail is Jonathan Allen, politics reporter for Congressional Quarterly. Jonathan, welcome.
Thank you.
We also welcome Holly Bailey, White House correspondent for Newsweek magazine. She's traveling with the McCain campaign. Holly, welcome to you as well.
Oh, glad to be with you.
And Jonathan, let's start with Barack Obama's VP selection. The shortlist is reported down to Senators Evan Bayh and Joe Biden and Virginia Governor Tim Kaine. First of all, what do you think of that list? And are other quarters still campaigning?
I think we don't know whether that list is accurate or not. It strikes me that the Obama campaign has been very, very good at keeping its cards close to the vest. Aides say that only the candidate himself and a small circle really know what his plans are, and a lot of it is speculation. That said, there are some reasons to look at those candidates, including that they have been vetted. There's been discussion about them being vetted. So that's a good starting point probably for looking at the announcement, but I wouldn't be shocked if there was a candidate outside of those three who was actually named.
Well, a New York Times CBS poll of delegates found that 28% of them wanted Hillary Clinton, by far the largest number supporting a candidate. But we should say that 60% of pledged Hillary candidates wanted her as the VP. Only 3% of the Obama delegates did.
But I'm surprised the percentage was so low for Senator Clinton, given the percentage of the votes she got,
right,
to be honest with you. But clearly there's more interest in her than anybody else, in part because she just ran a national campaign, and there was a lot of excitement on her side of that primary campaign, as well as Senator Obama's. You know, one of the unfortunate things for any other candidate who would be named is that they would be immediately compared to Hillary Clinton by some of her supporters, who would then find that candidate to be lacking in some important area when put up next to Hillary Clinton.
Well, you hate to speculate. Everyone hates to speculate, but I'm going to ask you to do it. Is there another name that we're not hearing here that you think, you know, could possibly pop out tomorrow if it happens tomorrow?
Well, I hate to read too much into things like this and into tea leaves, but the theme for the vice president's night at the convention, the Wednesday night theme, is Securing America's Future. That is the slogan of Wesley Clark's Political Action Committee, which is called WESPAC, Securing America's Future. So it's either him or they've reappropriated
his slogan
for someone else.
Well, Holly Bailey, with the McCain campaign, the Obama campaign has been ferociously tight-lipped. What about McCain? We're hearing from candidates, you know, on the Sunday talk shows who say they've been talked to, and Rich Lowry of the Conservative National Review has been saying that the McCain campaign is calling around asking how would people feel about his choosing a pro-choice candidate. So who were some of those names floating around? What are you hearing?
Well, you know, Senator McCain actually is partially at fault for sort of floating this pro-choice trial balloon. He gave an interview last week to Stephen Hayes of the Weekly Standard in which he said that he wouldn't rule out putting someone on the ticket who is pro-choice, which is something a little bit different than, you know, what he had said previously. Earlier this year he'd said, you know, well, I don't know if that person could actually win the nomination. So that seemed to indicate that they're, you know, a little bit more open than what he had previously said. But, you know, it's sort of like, you know, what's going on the Obama side. You know, Senator McCain and a few top aides are the only ones that are really involved in this process, and so a lot of these names that are floating around, you know, I think a lot of it just has to be a lot of speculation.
Right. Well, let's just throw them out anyway. Tom Ridge, former governor of Pennsylvania, Tim Pawlenty, governor of Minnesota, Mitt Romney, former governor of Massachusetts. But, you know, I want to ask you both how you think the campaigns are faring. A Sunday front page New York Times story quoted top Democrats worried that Obama wasn't refining his image, his definition of change or hope. But then on the opinion page of the same paper, Frank Rich wrote that the conventional wisdom that Obama is losing is bunk. Jonathan, to you first, do you have a sense of which campaign has more steam, has more momentum at this point?
Well, I think it's hard to tell. It's sort of an up and down, through the weeks and months, and really the focus of the campaign isn't going to happen until after Labor Day and these conventions. There's some thought that John McCain's been up a little bit lately, in part because of this crisis in Russia and Georgia and his ability to respond to it immediately, to quickly start talking about the area, and certainly. I think Senator Obama got less of a bounce than he would have liked out of his trip to Afghanistan and Iraq and then later Europe. But it's interesting. I think that if they weren't concerned and worried and complaining a little bit about the nominee, the folks that were quoted in that story wouldn't be Democrats. I mean, there's we see this every 4 years that the Democrats become very concerned with how their candidate's running, and there's a lot of hand-wringing about it. So it's not too surprising to see that.
Well, what do you think about Frank Rich's point that the reason that Obama hasn't pulled ahead, at least, even if he may not be flagging, is that the unknown candidate is John McCain? And Rich saying that once America gets to know McCain better, they will turn to Obama. What was your thoughts on that, first of all? Then we'll get to Holly Bailey, who has, I'm sure, some thoughts from the McCain campaign.
If the point is that that there are things about Senator McCain that the public doesn't know, or if it has some misimpressions about Senator McCain, then perhaps that's valid. But the idea that the public is more familiar or less familiar with Senator McCain than it is with Barack Obama is kind of silly after Senator McCain's been on the national stage for the last 30-plus years, and Senator Obama's been in the public eye for 4 or 5 years.
Well, Holly Bailey, I want to ask you, because both candidates also appeared in that forum with Christian leader Rick Warren over the past weekend. And in the conversation, they were each questioned individually, and they were asked what they thought their personal failures were. Now, Obama talked about his drug use as a young person. He's been very open about that. McCain talked about his regrets for his role in the failure of his first marriage. That would be his marriage to Carol McCain, who had a terrible, disfiguring accident while he was a POW in Vietnam. She had months of life-saving surgery after a car accident. It wasn't clear she'd walk again. And John McCain divorced her in 1980 and married his current wife, Cindy McCain, just 1 month later. Does his remark at that forum maybe, put his personal life and his current wife's finances and more, questions about her into play?
Well, I think those questions have already been into play for several months now. People have been focusing. I mean, let's be clear. Senator McCain in his book actually said the same language. He blames himself for the breakup of his marriage. He's always taken the blame for it. And while he doesn't often bring her up at town halls, for example, that his answer there was not surprising to me. But, the fact is people have been buzzing about this for a while, focusing on the fact that he married Cindy McCain so quickly and, sort of trying to make that into play. But, I don't know if that's really going to, take hold as much. Mm. I think what Frank Rich is referring to is the perception, McCain has a perception of being the straight talk. And, a lot of people view him as a moderate. But the fact is, as Senator McCain brought up at the forum this weekend, he has almost a 100% voting record on abortion. And I think a lot of people don't know that. And I would imagine Democrats are going to bring that up again and again and heading into November.
Well, I want to ask you, what else do you think? You've been with McCain for about a year now. What else do you think Americans don't know about John McCain, if Frank Rich's point is that Americans don't know him?
Well, Senator McCain, has been, on the road sort of touting some more conservative positions, including on abortion and marriage and so forth. But, honestly, the biography of Senator McCain is what a lot of people, I think, focus on. And I don't think there's much mystery about mm-hmm. that. And he's putting that, obviously, front and center at his campaign, his service, in the military, his time as a POW. That's, his theme is putting, the country first. And, I don't think there's much mystery there, to be honest with you.
Well, Jonathan Allen, I just want to ask you, again, going back to the momentum question, has John McCain pulled ahead on the issue of offshore drilling? He's been calling for it, drill here, drill now. Despite evidence that there's little oil offshore, it wouldn't be useful for 7 to 10 years. Accidents would have terrible consequences. Now, Barack Obama was against offshore drilling, then said he would support it as part of a compromise deal. And Nancy Pelosi, the House leader, has just said the same thing, that the Democrats are willing to perhaps give in on offshore drilling to win other trade-offs. So is this a John McCain win?
Well, I think, first of all, I would never let substance get in the way of the political argument there in terms of how much oil this might produce and how fast. I think with the Democrats moving more toward the position that McCain has, I think they felt like they were getting hammered on this issue on all fronts, not just at the presidential level, but we've seen the House Republicans hold informal sessions in the House of Representatives during the August recess to try to highlight the issue. And so I think the Democrats were feeling a lot of pressure on the issue, and I think that their capitulation on it has been an indication that they felt like they were losing it.
And Holly, there's been a lot of talk lately about the sharp tone of the McCain campaign. Now, some are saying that Barack Obama's come back from vacation with a sharp tone of his own. But to McCain, from the Paris Hilton ad, to the comments McCain made yesterday at the Convention of Veterans of Foreign Wars, he made pointed references to Barack Obama. Tell us about what many people think is the man behind this new strategy.
Well, it's, we noticed the sharper tone to McCain at the beginning of July when Steve Schmidt, who was a veteran of the Bush-Cheney campaign in 2004 and worked for Cheney in the White House, took over. His specialty is message and message control and sort of repeating the message again and again. And so we noticed that, after July 4th, McCain came out, has been trying to stick on message more, and has had a much sharper tone. And actually, they feel that this is really helping them. They point to the fact that McCain is, it's pretty much even in the national polls, but really they focus on the state polls where Senator McCain has pulled ahead in Colorado by a couple of points and in other swing states as a sign that the strategy is working.
And Jonathan, what's the overall sense of that, the sharper elbows?
Well, I think this is what campaigns generally try to do, is sharpen their rhetoric to sharpen the differences between their own campaign and the other one. And so they'll often take smaller issues or issues that are of emotional value rather than necessarily policy value, and really try to draw a sharp distinction between themselves and the other campaign. To some extent, it was surprising that Senator McCain wasn't able to do that before, that he was so off message for a long part of the campaign. Senator Obama is very, very good at staying on message. We heard during the primaries, hope, 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 and change, 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 over and over again, and now you're starting to hear a very strong message on the economy over and over and over again. And so, I think this is the McCain campaign in some ways catching up with the Obama campaign in terms of being very good at a traditional tactic, which is picking a message and sticking with it.
That's Jonathan Allen, politics reporter for Congressional Quarterly. We're also speaking with Holly Bailey, White House correspondent for Newsweek magazine. She's traveling with the McCain campaign, and I understand you got to get on the bus, Holly. So we're going to let you go. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Jonathan, we just want to ask you for a couple minutes on the other side of a one-minute break about the recent comments about Iraq from both candidates. We'll do that. And also, in just a few minutes, we'll check in Beijing. The fallen Chinese star, imagine Bruce Springsteen as a hurdler, and you'll get an idea of how big a star this young man is in China and how far he has fallen in their eyes. A really sad story, and we'll get to that as well. You're listening to Here and Now, back in a minute. We're checking in with presidential politics today, days ahead of next week's Democratic National Convention in Denver. And the Republicans follow in St. Paul, Minnesota, the week after. We've been packing. And it's also maybe the day before Senator Barack Obama announces his running mate. We've been speaking with Jonathan Allen of Congressional Quarterly. And Jonathan, I just want to check in on both candidates speaking before the Veterans of Foreign Wars. Here's a few seconds of Barack Obama speaking today.
It is time to press the Iraqis to take responsibility for their future. And the best way to do that is a responsible redeployment. The best way to do that, I believe, is a responsible redeployment of our combat brigades carried out in close consultation with commanders on the ground.
That's Barack Obama today. Here's Senator John McCain speaking before the convention yesterday.
Both candidates in this election pledged to end this war and bring our troops home. The great difference is that I intend to win it first.
Jonathan Allen, seems like slightly larger applause there, but both candidates were applauded. Your thoughts on how they're shaping that, and also on interesting news that's just come out, that among active duty service personnel, Barack Obama is outraising John McCain 6-1.
Yeah, I would just look at those numbers, the raw numbers, more than the ratio. It's a very small amount of money coming from active duty service members to presidential campaigns. If I'm not mistaken, we're talking about tens of thousands of dollars for Obama and about $10,000 for McCain. But it's not really a large amount of money, not a big enough pool, I don't think, to make a real assessment about how the troops feel about presidential candidates. It was interesting to hear those clips. I think that you're hearing Senator McCain really try to obscure any differences in terms of wanting to bring troops home. I think that he recognizes that Senator Obama has appealed to a lot of Americans in both political parties with his call for an end to the war, and Senator McCain is attempting to say, I also want an end to the war, and then trying to draw a difference and say, I want our guys coming back with their heads up high. The implication, of course, that Obama would want the opposite. With Senator Obama, it was interesting to hear him talk about close consultation with commanders on the ground. He says he wants to talk to commanders when he's speaking before this particular audience of veterans, and he said that before, but it sounded like a de-emphasis on the 16-month timetable, which, of course, he's been very consistent on through the campaign, that 16 months after he took office, he would complete this, what he calls, responsible redeployment.
Jonathan Allen of Congressional Quarterly. Gee, look where the time went. I was going to ask you about the cone of silence and the Hawaiian vacation, but we've run out of time.
As long as it's not Paris and Brittany.
That's right. Jonathan, thanks as always.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, to Beijing. China's biggest Olympic star, hurdler Liu Zhang, apologized to his country today for withdrawing from the qualifying heat of the 110-meter hurdles with a foot injury. It's hard to express how big a story this is in China. While many Americans don't even know his name, Liu is central to China's Olympic hopes and personal dreams. The gold he won in the Athens Games in this same event told the Chinese that they could compete in fields other than ping pong. He promised at that time that the Chinese runners would now unleash a yellow tornado on the world. Well, instead, he's limped off the Olympic stage at 25. Shira Springer is a sports reporter for the Boston Globe in Beijing. Shira, you said you were so looking forward to this event, and the Chinese considered his, Liu's event, the event of the Games, and now this. How is China reacting?
They are in complete shock. I was at the National Stadium yesterday when he withdrew from the race, and there were many, many people in the crowd of 91,000 crying in the post race press conference to explain what had happened. His personal coach, Sun Haiping, broke down in tears and was almost inconsolable at one point. So they are a nation in shock and just really devastated.
Well, there was a poll before the Games, and the Chinese were asked their wishes for the Games, and ranking first was watching Liu Zhang win gold. You know, tell us more about how big a star he is in China.
So he's sort of the embodiment of modern China. He represents, as you said, somebody who succeeded in a sport where Chinese athletes typically have not succeeded. And for that reason, he has sort of been a symbol of the nation and given the nation confidence that it can succeed, particularly in economic areas that they have not succeeded in before. He is a rock star here. He can't go anywhere without being mobbed. He is really, I mean, this is not overstating it, worshipped by a country of 1.3 billion people.
Well, and we understand that these are people who literally thought that genetically they couldn't perform in things like track. And then, of course, he had his huge success. Now, he's made millions, but he's still a part of the communist system. He was handpicked as a child, you know, his bones measured to direct him towards the perfect sport for his body. A part of his income goes to the state. So what happens? I mean, how has the state reacted to his withdrawal?
They have tried to manage it as carefully as they can. I mean, the press conference yesterday was a good example of Chinese-style damage control. You had the national team coach, you had the personal coach, and they were very much talking about how much Liu Zhang wanted to perform well for the nation. The vice president sent a telegram to Liu Zhang saying that he hoped he returned stronger and continue to struggle for the people of China in his hurdle race.
So it seems as if the government's going to stand by him, and we read that the Chinese propaganda authorities issued an edict to Chinese journalists mandating that they not criticize Liu or question his injury. Will he run again?
He will not run again this season, but I expect he'll be back on the European circuit next season. I anticipate he will attempt to redeem himself and China in the 2012 Olympics in London.
And I just, you know, with so many 1.3 billion people seeing a new path for themselves because of this one young man, do they suddenly fear that maybe they can't compete in these ways?
I think what they got a taste of is that, you know, you can't control everything. I think what you find here is China seems to think that you can, if you just work hard enough and you control your environment, success will happen. I think it was actually a valuable lesson for the Chinese, where even at the best of planning, you can't control everything. And that was the case for Liu Zhang yesterday. He had an injury that flared up. He simply could do nothing about it.
Shira Springer, sports reporter for the Boston Globe in Beijing. Shira, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, tomorrow on Here and Now, who owns ancient antiquities like the Elgin marbles that Britain has but Greece wants back? Well, we'll meet an American museum director who says maybe they shouldn't go back. That's tomorrow. Still ahead today, are you looking for a job as a nuclear engineer? After the news, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.
There was a vibration.
I don't know that accident is the right word.
Accident is the right word.
The film The China Syndrome was released just a few days before the very real nuclear accident at Three Mile Island in Pennsylvania. But that was way back in 1979. The terrible accident at Chernobyl in Ukraine was in 1986. Ancient history to a crop of students who now see nuclear engineering as the new hot job. But will there be enough of those students? The American Nuclear Society estimates that 700 new engineers will have to graduate every year to fill a new worldwide demand. Right now, only about 249 graduate yearly. So American colleges are scrambling to rekindle nuclear programs shut down when nuclear energy was in decline. Here in the U.S., Republican John McCain has said if elected, he would build 45 new nuclear reactors by the year 2030. Democrat Barack Obama has raised concerns about safety and waste storage, but he's not ruling out nuclear power. So where will the required workers come from? Reporter Allison Goh examined this problem for U.S. News and World Report. She's in their Washington studio. And Allison, I understand you have a friend who's a grad student in nuclear engineering, and that's how you got into this story. Why? What was happening to him?
Many government agencies and companies are just throwing tons of money into nuclear engineering. This is exactly what happened to my friend. I mean, it was a great opportunity for him, and it's what's happening to all his colleagues.
Well, and when you say throwing money at him, you mean directly at him? You know, is he getting grants or scholarships? Or
exactly. Grants and opportunities over the summer to work at research labs. I believe he worked at the Livermore Lab in California. If you want to do something in nuclear engineering, they'll find something for you.
Well, and this is interesting because you write, on the one hand, that so many more students are needed, but on the other, you're right, the colleges aren't prepared for the ones that are there, people like your friend.
There aren't enough labs. You know, a bunch of research reactors have been shut down in the past 30 years, and academic programs themselves have gone away. We used to have about 65 to 70 at its height. Now we're at about 29. There just aren't schools that are teaching this, but they're coming back. That's the good news,
right,
especially for the nuclear engineers out there.
Well, good news for the industry, but some would say, well, wait a second, is this good news? Now, you're right, there are three times more students applying than 5 years ago, and it's largely because they don't have the same fears that maybe their parents did of nuclear power.
That's right. I think nuclear was a taboo word for a while. You know, it was mixed up with weaponry. But now it's all about energy and trying to be carbon free. And that's what nuclear means now. And I think a lot of students have kind of gotten that message instead of the one from the Cold War era.
They've been filling up their gas tanks. So to them, this is an issue of energy. But what about concerns about where to put the waste from nuclear plants, security with plants in a time of terrorism, or the potential for just plain, you know, accidents at plants.
A lot of people in the industry will tell you that this waste disposal issue is a non-issue. And the research they are doing is going into waste disposal and to be more green and these issues that'll, you know, they're trying to directly address the critics. They're doing that with science, and they're doing that with a little bit better PR than they've had in the past 30 years.
Well, and of course, we have to say that, you know, the people whose towns are being considered for the waste sites don't think that it's a non-issue. But, you know, it brings the question, why is there such a surge? Because there are some questions about waste and security, is it all because it's shifted to an energy question?
I really think so. I actually was talking to a colleague about this. You know, what has changed? And I really think that what's changed is that there is less oil, natural gas, and coal because of global demand for energy. And I think nuclear is one option that is proven. I mean, we know that nuclear works as an energy source. Now, the next issue is to talk about waste disposal, as all the things that people worry about.
Well, and putting aside the many questions about waste disposal and security, it obviously has become a fast track for kids who are interested in engineering. What's happening at the schools that, you know, either shut down their program or never had a program? I mean, how are universities responding to the demand?
One of the biggest problems is staffing faculty right now. In the past 30 years, there haven't been too many new nuclear engineers, and these are the people who would be joining the ranks of junior faculty. So what they're doing is they're pulling out people from retirement who are glad to join the so-called nuclear renaissance. But, you know, there are people who have been sitting out on the lines for the past 5 years, and they're coming back to the universities to teach the new generation.
I just want to say there was a lot of reaction to your story on the U.S. News & World Report website. Steve from Connecticut wrote, as a 38-year veteran of the nuclear industry, I'm one of those contemplating retirement. There's been an effort to retain my services at my present company. I've been sought by other companies. It's not just a boon for new engineers and mechanics, but for those who maybe, you know, for a long time didn't see their services needed, and now perhaps they won't retire.
Right, exactly. And they're being brought into the university system, maybe a little bit cushier job than being an operator. I mean, it's a real problem right now. And actually, if you want to talk about shortages, the government and a bunch of industries are also throwing money into technical schools and vocational schools, because a huge glut is who's going to build these reactors if we are going to build them. If we're going to build 45 reactors, those people don't exist either.
So shortage of workers, shortage of teachers. What about a shortage of research facilities? You mentioned the research reactors, and you write about a concern that today's students won't get hands-on experience in a research reactor before they actually head off to a real reactor, because
right,
there just aren't enough right now. Isn't that, that would seem a problem.
It's not as big of a problem as you might imagine. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission does have their own reactors, and they try to spread them out regionally so that every section of the United States has some sort of access to a reactor. But it's not the same thing as stepping off out of one school building and into another, and now you have a reactor. But I think the consensus is it's not that big of a deal, but it does hamper a little bit of the research, and it's a great recruiting tool, to be honest.
Well, as you write, and we're well aware, the American nuclear renaissance, you know, isn't realized, but it certainly is in other countries. And we understand that American schools are scrambling to educate the workers for those facilities.
The United States has some of the best safety training in the world. And what schools are expecting is to have a ton of international students. Already, the international students make about 40% of the best programs, graduate programs. Regardless if we're building and if we're growing, China and India are. And so, you know, these engineers and these academic programs are glad to take in international students and then send them back home with proper training.
You quote the chair of the University of Michigan's nuclear engineering department saying, hey, an accident anywhere in the world affects all of us. So we're happy to have trained the foreign workers as well.
Something interesting that's happening is that the United States and India have this nuclear information trading agreement that they just signed off on. And so now the deans are expecting a huge influx of Indian international students, because they really think this is a global issue. This is not just about United States and their energy needs.
So as you write, schools are really scrambling to gear up their programs and train nuclear engineers, but this costs a lot of money. And the industry is investing, and Congress is investing, and the schools are investing. But is there any concern that, you know, with just one Chernobyl or one Three Mile Island, it really, you know, shuts down the entire industry, at least sets it back for a while? Has anyone, you know, said to you that there's some concern about ramping up because, you know, the rug may be pulled out from under them.
You know, I think that's why they're concentrating so hard on these issues. And I think that if something like that happened, maybe there's a little worry, but no one's ever expressed that to me. You know, they need more money to do this proper research, but don't take away our money or else we won't be able to do it correctly and do it the best way we can.
Allison Goh, a reporter for U.S. News & World Report. We'll link you to her story about the new demand for nuclear engineers at our website, here-now.org. Allison, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
And a quick heads up on stories we're working on for the rest of the week. We're going to speak to David Frum. He says TV has killed the political conventions and celebrated Western writer Rick Bass on decades of trying to save Montana's wilderness and, frankly, being a pain in the neck while doing it. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, the fall is nearly upon us. Here in Boston, Patriots fans are trying to discern the seriousness of quarterback Tom Brady's mysterious foot injury. Well, maybe his yoga practice will help him. The University of Wyoming football team is hoping it helps them. They have their first game next week after a summer spent partly on the yoga mat. It's a voluntary program for all athletes at the school, and about a third of the team has been showing up. Wyoming Public Radio's Addie Goss brings us this story.
Hurry up! Get out! Hurry up! Let's go!
The Wyoming football team did this last season. And the season before that.
Squat down.
And the season before that. This year, they decided to add something else to the mix.
Taking a deep inhale and making sure that the belly is filling all the way up with air as you breathe in.
There are no candles in this yoga studio. The guys' mats are lined up on the 10-yard line of UW's indoor football field. Everyone's knees and elbows are coated in sticky rubber pebbles from the turf.
So you should feel a stretch through the back body.
Yoga instructor Emily Brown is a fit 5'2", half the size of some of the men in this room. She says normally at the beginning of a yoga class, there's total silence and meditation. But the first day of this class started a different way.
The coordinator of the whole thing took me up to the front and says, "Listen up, this is Emily. She's going to be teaching you yoga today. You all better listen and pay attention."
That pep talk came from strength coach Brian Herzog.
You know, most of our guys' pictures of yoga is, you know, women in leotards or, you know, I don't know, maybe they thought they were going to be chanting and stuff like that. I don't know. But, you know, I try to explain to them there's many different forms and styles of yoga. So
Herzog says it wasn't going to work to tell his team to grab a mat and get ready for poses with names like Chaturanga Dandasana. But telling them the poses might help with flexibility got their attention.
I think we're probably the most inflexible team.
Practicing yoga helps with proper alignment, how to strengthen abs to preserve the back, how not to crunch the neck, how to loosen up hips and hamstrings without pulling something. Herzog says that'll help the players avoid injuries when they're crashing into each other on the field and landing in contorted piles. But it's slow going. Take offensive lineman Kyle Howard. Howard's too big for his yoga mat, so when he hefts forward into a lunge, his front foot lands on the turf.
You know, some guys will give you a hard time. You tell them to come and, you know, and see how hard it is. It's, you know, it's not easy.
But yoga should help the team in the weight room. Stretching will widen their range of motion, help them do lifts more fully, and opening up the hips should help with all that squatting. Linebacker Weston Johnson's already noticed that yoga's helped him rest up for the next day of training.
Just from previous summers and stuff and how I've been after workouts, I can tell just a faster recovery, I think, from yoga and stretching.
Emily Brown tells everyone it's time for their jump through. Start in downward dog with your hands on one end of your mat, your feet on the other end, and your backside in the air. Then tighten your abs and hop forward until you can sit down cross-legged. It's awkward. Brown says this crowd isn't always easy. At the end of each class is something called Shavasana. Everyone lies down on their backs, closes their eyes, and melts into total relaxation for 10 minutes.
With this particular class, I can't really do that. It's like I get them to lay on their backs and I try to explain to them to close their eyes. And this is the time where you relax and where you integrate like a feeling of peace and relaxation. But it's like literally I'll get them to lay down. 30 seconds later, their eyes will pop open. They'll start wiggling their fingers and like poking the people next to them.
But that doesn't daunt her. There may be only 7 classes in this summer session, but Brown thinks the team can learn something that will last a lifetime.
I hope for them that they can see and understand the benefit of this kind of a practice, and that they can understand that if they continue it, that it can really help prevent injury and can carry on through their life when they quit kind of their athletics to keep them healthy and flexible through that time as well.
And maybe all this stretching will even help the team recover from the 5-7 record it posted last year.
That story from Wyoming Public Radio's Addie Goss. We'll be back in 1 minute with the story of New England's last rose farm. They're closing up shop in a minute here and now. A few years ago, there were a dozen rose farms in New England and New York State. Well, the last of them is now closing its doors. It's not easy to grow delicate roses in the New England winter, but that's not the problem. Pinchbeck Rose Farm in historic Guilford, Connecticut, has been doing that since 1929, weathering the Great Depression and the oil crisis of the 1970s to become an institution in town. But now owner Tom Pinchbeck says because of foreign competition, he can no longer keep cultivating the 90,000 rose bushes that have bloomed in 2 enormous greenhouses on his 110-acre farm.
That's the biggest single-span greenhouse in the country, as far as I know. So,
this is huge. It's like bigger than a train station.
This house is pretty big. It's 2 football fields in length.
That's Here and Now's Lynn Menegon speaking with Tom. She visited Pinchbeck Rose Farm, where she also met longtime Guilford resident Fred Olson, who was buying flowers with his wife Jane.
It's always just been a fixture here in town. I mean, my very first job was across the street at the White House Florist.
How old were you?
At the time, I was 17.
Customers Bill McEwen and Constance Coles were looking over some rose bushes.
We'd like to adopt some of the roses that they will no longer need.
This is the farm.
Lynn asked owner Tom Pinchbeck, what is the heart of a rose farm?
Well, the heart of the rose farm, I guess, is in the greenhouses.
We'll let Lynn take the story from here. She says, at first, Tom's heart didn't seem to be in it anymore.
The weeds are growing up, and we're not even really watering. Now, see, they're all sort of getting past their prime. 2 months ago, when you came into our greenhouses, you'd see a lot of green and maybe some buds coming if we were cutting in that section. Now what we're looking at are all those buds have bloomed open because we've abandoned harvesting this area. So it's much more...
So it's like 4,000 rose plants that are dying.
Yeah, except in here now we've got 16 beds, so we've got 16,000 rose bushes. They're not even really dying. They're just, you know, they're not being cared for. They're blooming out.
So what is it? I mean, when you look at this, does it kind of break your heart, kind of?
Yeah, a little bit. It's a little kind of disconcerting. In wintertime, we're heating. We have steam heat, and we try to maintain 64-degree nighttime temperatures. So that's pretty warm for single-pane glass, you know.
2 football fields long of single-pane glass.
Yeah, and then we have another 4 in this house, so we've got a total of 6 football fields.
How do you get the vents of this huge greenhouse open?
The top vents were 2 put on an electric motor in the 60s, I guess. My dad did that. It used to be all hand cranks, you know. You'd have a guy who just opened the vents all day. He'd be like, all right, it's getting a little cold, roll them down. And my dad was pretty sharp. In the late 70s, he put in a wood burner. But when you asked me the heart of the rose operation, I thought, that'd be the boilers. I think the greenhouse probably is where the most interest is, but in terms of keeping the circulation system going in the greenhouses, it really has to do with the boiler. So
let's go down and
check that out. All right, we're entering into the boiler room now. It's kind of...
It's an old brick building.
Yeah, it's two big
84-inch boilers. They're fire tube boilers.
Okay, this looks like the Titanic.
It's probably what the Titanic had, not too far from it. Takes a lot of wood.
What is this? What are you doing?
That's a fan that blows the sawdust. Once the sawdust gets into the front of the boiler, then this blows it onto the grate surface inside the firebox.
Jeez.
My dad told me that we used to burn close to 2,500 gallons of oil in a 24-hour period, say, in the coldest day of the year, say, a storm conditions, blizzard conditions. That's a lot of oil, you know, and it put a lot of other guys out of business. But we had converted to wood.
So what was the killer? What was the thing that you just couldn't, you tried out, you got wood burning?
We put in, over the years, many labor-saving devices, such as automatic irrigation systems and things like that. But you just can't get around cutting. And harvesting is a critical part of our business, and that was something that just took a lot of time. And you just cannot compete with, $1, $2 a day labor in other parts of the world, and the infrastructure changed in other countries. And
you mean they could get the flowers here better and faster?
Yeah, they got the flowers here better and faster, and they streamlined their systems too. And they also got varieties that shipped better and lasted longer.
Tom told me that imported roses were once only a small fraction of the U.S. market. Now almost all cut roses sold in the U.S. come from overseas, mostly from Colombia, and their roses can enter the United States duty-free. So this gentleman here is coming from, a florist.
Yeah. Yep. Not sure what that's all about, but that'll probably be one of the last ones. You know, growing roses is like, it was like banging your head against the wall, you know? It's hard to make it work. And our roses were more expensive because it took more, our labor was more expensive, and our heating and just all the inputs that go into growing a rose. It's more expensive to do here in the Northeast than it is in Colombia, and except for transport. That was the one thing that we had over them. But South American roses are huge, and they're pretty, but they don't have that sort of delicateness to them as much. They're very woody. And they don't have necessarily, they're a little more inconsistent than a rose that's locally grown.
Inconsistent meaning?
Sometimes the varieties grown aren't really even designed to open up. They're not bred to open up. So they sort of sit there, which is great for shipping it 3,000 miles. It doesn't bloom as if you had a rose in a rose garden outside. And that's always what we prided ourselves in, that the rose that you brought home would open up fully as if it were on a bush outside in the middle of summer. Mm. So you had a piece of summertime or springtime in your home.
The machine that used to sort roses by stem size won't be working much longer, nor will Pinchbeck's shipping manager, Cliff. He's been working at the farm for years, with full benefits. He was putting some of the last roses of summer into a big walk-in refrigerator.
After 15 years to get attached to the roses and meeting nice customers, and they come in with a smile and go out with a smile. You know, it's a change. I get used to having roses on my table each day.
You get to bring home roses.
My wife. She loves the lavender.
Ah, the lavender roses.
It's the most fragrance of them all.
Mm.
Doesn't last as long as the other ones, but.
So as summer fades, so will the delicate smell of roses from Pinchbeck Farm. For a little while longer, they'll sell roses to customers who stop in. But then, well, Tom Pinchbeck is talking with Guilford town officials. He's hoping to put together a land development deal that will let him keep some of the land for farming, maybe for produce, but.
Not roses, no. I don't think roses. A little ready to move on to the next chapter on that.
That's Tom Pinchbeck speaking with Here Now's Lynn Menegon. Pinchbeck is closing down his family's wholesale rose farm in Connecticut after nearly 80 years in business. For more information, go to our website, here-now.org.